Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm just grand this morning. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I want to talk about something today that I think a show like this should talk about. I want to talk today a little bit about tipping, and we've done shows on tipping and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate before. But I want to talk about something that, as restaurateurs, I think may be a little bit of a delicate subject for us to talk about.
Sure.
And one of the things I'm really hoping is to get some feedback from folks in our audience to send to Mark at restaurantguysradio.com or Francis at restaurantguysradio.com. Just your feedback and kind of what you think is appropriate. Because one of the things that I want to talk about is it ever appropriate to tip 0%? Now, obviously, I'm an over-tipper, okay, in the business, and a lot of people who are in the business who made their living via tips at one point in their life or not are generally big tippers.
Right.
But I have a range from which I will tip, and that range basically, if things are extraordinarily bad and somebody does something really, really wrong, can go from 10% to 25% or 30%, depending on what services have been.
I would say I would almost never go to 30% unless it was a small bill.
Yeah,
like at a bar.
Small bill. That's what I'm talking about.
But if it's dinner for $100, I'm not going to leave $30 unless.
I mean, unless somebody's done something extraordinary for me.
Something extraordinary has happened. Yeah.
I might do that to somebody who I really liked. And again, that would be because I was in the business. That would be because,
right,
you know, I felt.
But I think a lot of folks are in the 15 to 25% range for, you know.
Well, clearly most people are in the 15 to 20% range. That's that's where most tippers are, and that's where.
For good service. When you get good service, it's 15 to 20%.
Correct.
I think me, for something, when something's extraordinary, I've done 25%. And sometimes, you know, I'm always conscious as well, like if the house sends me a course or somebody buys me a bottle of wine, which happens occasionally, I have to be sure that maybe that the waiter doesn't suffer because the house bought me a bottle of something.
Right.
So I'm leaving 20% on the discounted total. That doesn't make any sense at all. So I shouldn't be less generous to the waiter because the house was very generous to me.
Right.
It is appropriate, I think, Mark, to tip nothing.
See, I
think when the waiter spits in your face.
Right. I think that for me, the 0% tip can only come at a time when the waiter has done something offensive. Not something incorrect.
Not something accidental.
Not something incorrect, even. You know, even if he did something incorrectly on purpose. I'm sorry, and when I say incorrectly on purpose, what I'm talking about there is if that's the way he does it.
Oh yeah, that's what I mean. It's a mistake.
And it's right.
Or something that you don't like, or you know, I don't know.
Right. For instance, the waiter doesn't know how to appropriately open wine, and were to shake my wine before opening the bottle.
Yeah, that's not a zero tip.
It would lower the tip.
Might be a 10% tip if it was just wine.
And I
would say to the waiter, you know,
please don't do that.
Don't do that. can you put that
bottle
back? I'll take a different non-shaken one.
Yes, absolutely. But for me, a 0% tip is only appropriate. And again, I would love to hear feedback from the folks listening to the show right now. A 0% tip is only appropriate where a waiter is doing something to me purposefully with malice.
I remember the lowest tip I left $1 on a.
See, I've never done that. So share.
I left $1 on a 20-something dollar tab at one of my favorite bars and restaurants, and one of yours too. And I'll tell you what it is after the show. I went to this.
Or if you come to the restaurant, we'll tell you what.
I went into this place. It's a bar that opened up around in Manhattan around the time that we opened up in New Jersey, and it was our regular late night place for a long time. And I know the bartenders by name. One of the bartenders, the original bartenders, is still there. I know all the managers. I know the and it's great. And it's a great place. And it's a busy place.
So what caused you to leave a 4% tip?
I'll be honest, I usually get treated very well there because I've been a regular since the week they opened, mm-hmm. right? And I'm in the business, and they're in the business. A lot of folks in the business go there, and that was fine. But I showed up at about late in the afternoon or early in the evening maybe before they got busy. And there was a new, relatively new bartender behind the bar. I probably hadn't been there in a month and a half, and there was a new bartender behind the bar. And it's a one-bartender bar. And I walked up to the bar, and I ordered a drink, and I stood there for a long time.
Mm.
And the bartender was flirting with a couple of girls. Now, this is a tiny little bar. This is a 10-stool bar, 9-10-stool bar maybe. And I couldn't get a drink. I was invisible, right? And so I finally said, excuse me, can I get a beer? And I got a beer, and he, I don't know that he even looked at me for a minute or two, and then went back to talking to the girls. I finished my drink. I was there. I had a book. Mm-hmm. I finished my drink, and I literally stood up because I thought that would get his, because nothing would get this guy's attention. And he looked at me with derision. He was a very cool, good-looking guy, flirting mm-hmm. with some beautiful women at the end of the bar. And I couldn't get a drink, and I literally went over and I said, "Can I?" And I was going to have dinner there. I didn't stay and have dinner,
mm-hmm.
and I left a dollar. And I thought, because I wanted to call him, I felt, and this is interesting. I felt doubly hurt because this is my bar, mm-hmm. you know. And I felt, isn't this weird? As a customer, I've been coming here for a dozen years, and you're the new bartender, and you look down your nose at me. And I don't care how you look at me. Actually, I do. But I can't get a drink here. And I felt it was purposeful. I felt mm-hmm. he was saying, yeah, you don't matter. Whatever you are, middle-aged guy in a suit, you don't matter. I'm talking to the hot models. And I thought, I left a dollar. But I'll tell you what else I did. As I was leaving, I called the restaurant back. And I know the manager by name, but mm-hmm. I hadn't been there for me to talk to during the experience. I said, you know, I just left your bar, and I got to tell you, I've been coming here for 10 years. First negative experience I had, but if it had been my first time there, I'd never come back. And I just, I was hurt. That's what it was. I was hurt. I mm-hmm. felt personally affronted. So that I think that's why, and I left a buck or two. But I also quite clearly stated why. So that's a long-winded explanation.
That's okay. Let me give you another scenario.
Okay.
Because I think this happens a lot. And I see people who don't truly understand the restaurant business leaving bad tips for waiters for things that aren't their fault. And at the same time, I also see people making excuses for waiters that it might be something else that's going wrong in the restaurant when it's really the waiter's fault.
Mm-hmm.
So let me give you an example, okay? Food takes an exceptionally long time to come out of the kitchen, and you're waiting a long time, and you just feel like your meal took too long, and everything just took too long during the course of the meal. Is that something that the waiter should be tipped less for?
You know, I know what you're speaking about an experience we had recently with a number of friends, and this discussion came up. We were all, some of us are in the business, some of us aren't in the business. We're all out to dinner. And, you know, Mark, I still don't know where I am on that one. Mm-hmm. I mean, being in the business, I want to say it wasn't the waiter's fault. But, you know, from the customer's perspective, I think, you know what? I didn't get great service. Mm-hmm. And if you as a waiter are working in a place that doesn't allow you to give me great service, then you should go work in another place. Because for whatever reason, you didn't give me great service.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you were unable to give me great service. But, of course, you and I would always look at this and, you know, it comes down to, I think, with you and I, is if the waiter comes over and makes us feel like we haven't been forgotten
right.
about, that he keeps coming out and saying, I'm so sorry, the food is taking a little long in the kitchen, and doesn't lie to me and say it'll be here in 5 when it's there in 15,
mm-hmm.
but also doesn't not come back to the table because he can't bring me the food.
Well, that's a very common waiter mistake. A very common waiter, maitre d', owner mistake is things are going wrong at that table. Stay
I can't
away
go near
from,
there.
I better not go near that table. Yeah. They're going to yell at me.
Run to
when,
the problem.
When the reality is, go to most people and say and tell them what's really happening, and most people will be forgiving if it's not the second, third, fourth time that it's happened. All right, one more scenario for you.
Okay, well, you didn't weigh in on that. Do you agree with me, or do you have a different take?
I think that one of the things that I'm always looking for, and is very difficult to tell in some scenarios, is was, am I getting slow service because the waiter forgot to do something, forgot to put an order in the kitchen, forgot to tell somebody to make the coffees, forgot, or am I getting slow service because the restaurant's has an endemic problem? That's one of the things that I try and put together before I make a decision of whether I'm going to tip. But I think you've hit on the solution to that is the waiter, you know.
Do you care about me? Does the waiter make me feel cared about? Yep.
So that's one. I read a magazine article just a couple of days ago, and it was the publisher of the magazine, one of the restaurant trade magazines. The publisher of the magazine was berating a restaurant because he went in there on a day that the restaurant should have known was going to be very busy,
mm-hmm.
and there were only two bartenders working, and it took a long time to get a drink. And I was thinking about this from the perspective, obviously, as I often do, I try and take both perspectives, as I am a diner and someone who runs restaurants. And I was thinking about the perspective, as I read this article, of the restaurant owner in these difficult economic times. And one of the things that happens in when your restaurant's not as busy as you want it to be is on the nights when you have to turn the volume all the way up, when everything's going to be jumping, it's Valentine's Day, whatever the case may be, I think restaurants in general are less prepared for those really busy nights than they were 3 years ago.
When every Saturday night was a really busy night.
You had three busy
nights
or four or five busy nights a week.
That's interesting.
And now you're having one busy night a month or one busy night every 2 weeks, really busy. And you know what I mean, but when I say busy, I mean, you know, you're just, you couldn't be any busier, and there's a line down the hallway.
And if you're in a struggling...
People are standing around.
And if you're in a struggling business, as so many people are, especially outside the major cities, you must take as much business as you can on that night, and your staff gets less seasoned as to what they can take.
Exactly.
I mean, we have the theaters, frankly, to keep us sharp. We can't, you know, we always have like, oh my God, the sky's falling, right? So, but I think that, you know, if you're out in an area where you've gone from, where you're not used to doing that sort of volume, and then the volume comes in, but you know what?
But it's not just that. It's also the fact that I no longer have. So let's give an example of the scenario I was talking about before. There are two bartenders working, and they're working fairly quickly, but it's taking me a long time to get drinks because it's really, really busy. Well, if that restaurant is not used to being really, really busy, it may be that those two bartenders may be the only two main bartenders that restaurant has working for them anymore.
That's true.
There may not be a third bartender to call in and to work because he had to quit because he couldn't earn a living anymore because the restaurant was too slow.
So the host bartends on
Tuesdays. It's an interesting dilemma that I see, and fortunate, you know, again, you know, we're pretty fortunate in that we have a fairly even business throughout our week. We do a lot of business with business clientele during the week and a fair amount of business on Saturdays. So it's not a dilemma we have. But I do sometimes, just as an example, our business is much slower in the summer than it is in September. There's a ramp-up period for my staff in September when we get really busy again to get everybody kind of acclimated and trained again. And if that's only happening to you once a month or on Valentine's Day or on New Year's Eve or what have you, I could see where restaurants would really, really struggle with being busy.
I can too. But then the question is, but as the consumer, you're open. You, the drink's not cheaper because, you know, you didn't
again,
give me a discount.
That's why I wanted to include it in this discussion.
Yeah, and I think that maybe if a bartender in a really busy bar like that should probably expect to get less than a tip.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I do agree.
Because you have more people.
I absolutely agree.
That you're giving less good service to. Wow, that's a tough spot, man. Yeah. That's a tough spot to be in.
I was trying to give you tough spots. I was trying to put you on the spot today with some tough questions.
That was good. That was a good little I don't know that we learned anything, but I feel really
Well, what I'm hoping to learn, I'm truthfully hoping to learn from the listeners here. Please send us some emails. Please let me know. Weigh in on this. Let us know what you think. Maybe we'll revisit it.
Yeah, so send us your emails on tipping. You can send it to francis@restaurantguysradio.com or mark@restaurantguysradio.com. And if we get some good ones, maybe we'll even read them on the air. But we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And today, our guest is Coleman Andrew. Coleman was founder of Savoir Magazine, where he served as editor-in-chief for a long time. His wonderful book on Spanish cooking, specifically Catalan cooking, is called Catalan Cuisine. And he's just recently written another book on a whole new kind of Catalan cuisine called Ferran, the inside story of El Bulli and the man who reinvented food.
Coleman Andrews, welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be here.
So I think everybody who's a foodie knows what who Ferran Adrià is and what El Bulli is, but why don't you tell our audience, I mean, it's fair to say it's been considered the best restaurant in the world or among the top one or two restaurants in the world for quite a while now.
Sure. He's a chef in Spain, in the Catalonia region of Spain, so that's around Barcelona, although his restaurant is a couple hours north of Barcelona, right up by the French border. And He's a guy that, as you say, has been named in all kinds of polls. I mean, he thinks it's kind of silly. He doesn't like the idea of best restaurant and best chef. But he has been named the best chef in the world, greatest chef in the world, and his restaurant has been repeatedly hailed in similar terms. It's a curious place because it's very isolated. It takes a real act of will to get there, and you might not have any reason to get there because the demand for seats for the last 10 years or so has been so great that they can serve about 8,000 meals a year. They get hundreds and hundreds of thousands of requests. So it's a pretty long, pretty much of a long shot that people will be able to get in. But what he has done there and why he's so significant, I think, is that he's really completely rethought his whole approach to food, the materials that he used to make food, the form in which it's presented, and when I say the man who reinvented food in my subtitle, that is a little bit of an exaggeration or poetic license or whatever. Because, hey, you know, there was nothing wrong with food in the first place. He didn't have to reinvent it. But what I mean is that he's just thought of completely new ways. I mean, things that would just amaze you to present flavors that may be very familiar to you. And it's a lot of fun. And it's not, I don't think of it as pretentious and mannered at all. It's very, it's a roller coaster ride. It's great fun.
We know it's a unique place. If Francis and I are going to spend an entire show talking about a restaurant we've never been to,
yeah.
Which right. Usually we don't spend a lot of time on restaurants that we've never gone to.
But
I understand.
I think that again, folks in the industry are going to know, so bear with us for a moment or two. But
sure.
Ferran Adrià is the guy who, when you say reinvented food or rethought food, he certainly reinvented restaurant food, and he came up with unusual techniques. And it's funny because I don't want you to get the impression like, oh, he's the best chef in the world, and you think of, you know, a French guy who's making a great sauce that is
right.
somewhat familiar. He is a thinker about food, and why don't you give some examples of some of the things that he's – I mean, the ubiquitous thing now is that every forward-looking chef is talking about – is doing a foam that Ferran Adrià started, you know, 9.5 years ago. But what are some of the other things that would fall into the category of – and how do you feel about – and how does he feel about the term molecular gastronomy?
Well, he hates the term. We'll come back to that.
I knew that was a lob, Coleman. That was a lob.
Among the things he's done, I mean, this whole thing of foams, which actually I think the foams are ebbing a little bit, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a period when they were very popular, but that came out of just a desire to make kind of a mousse, which is something that's classic in French cooking and other kinds of European cuisine, but to make the lightest possible mousse you could. So instead of binding it with gelatin or eggs or cream to try to reduce the whatever the raw material was to its essence. Beyond that, if you've heard the term deconstruction, a familiar dish deconstructed, in other words, sort of taken the parts kind of separated out and then reassembled in a different way. That's a technique that he really invented. There's a very famous technique which is a little harder to do, so it's not quite as widespread, although there are chefs in America doing it, what he calls spherification. This is treating a liquid, usually a pretty intense reduction of some fruit or vegetable, as treating it with a couple of chemicals, and we'll come back to the issue of chemicals in a minute, that make it form little globules of itself. So best way I can describe it is you can taste his most famous one probably, is a spherified olive, which looks like a big plump, kind of gray or rather brownish green olive. And you put it into your mouth, and it's sheer essence of olive, because all it is the juice of the olive surrounded by a skin that has been formed from the juice of the olive. You know, the old-fashioned chocolate pudding, when you get that skin that would form on top or something, and it was basically the same thing that was inside, but because it was on top, it formed the skin. This is, in a way, that same idea. And he's done this with everything from lentils to caviar to liquefied Parmesan cheese to any kind of fruit you can mention. And it's a remarkable effect. In the case of the olives, I actually would argue they taste more like olives than olives do, because he's taken out the water from the olives. He's taken out the kind of the pith that would be just a solid material. And all you taste is sheer, pure, concentrated olive.
I think one of the things that's interesting in folks that try and do this type of cuisine is people can sort of fall in love with the technique of something. And
right.
I remember I had a cocktail once. It was a Cape Cod, which is not a tremendous cocktail. It's vodka and cranberry juice.
Right.
And it was done by a very famous mixologist bartender. And he had spherified basically the essence of a Cape Cod of vodka and cranberry juice down into little caviar pearls. And it was interesting, but it wasn't pleasant. You know, so I thought, well, that's great that you did that, but why do I care? You know, and I think the Ferran has spawned this whole movement of people saying, look at what I can do.
Right.
But do you think that sometimes when people imitate Ferran, that it becomes more about the method than the method is in service to a goal that's worthwhile?
Right. Well, I think you could argue the same about, of course, any technique going back as far as you want in culinary history, that just because people can do something, they will do it. I mean, I've had, I remember somebody making a sauce out of meat, not a meat sauce in the sense of a spaghetti sauce or something, but kind of there was a vegetable dish. This was some restaurant in Colorado, and I think it was pork that had been turned into a kind of thick, glutinous sauce that was just drizzled over the vegetables. And I said, well, I understand, you know, he's taking the idea of meat sauce and working with it, but it was just a texture that was kind of disgusting. And I think, you know, you have to use a little common sense with cooking of any kind. And I just think with what he has done, and he always says, you know, if people use my techniques and they make bad food, it's really not my fault any more than if you have a really bad pizza. It's not the fault of the guy in Naples that first invented pizza.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think Ferran has a lot of disciples, and what we know throughout history is when you have a lot of disciples, some of them will well represent your principles, and some of them maybe not so much.
Mm.
Right, but, you know, the other thing that's very interesting, though, if you talk to Ferran, first of all, he's absolutely open and generous with anything that he's figured out how to do, even if he just figured it out yesterday. If you come along as a fellow professional and you want to know how to do it, he will show you how to do it. He doesn't like telling his diners, the layman, how he does his effects, because, as he says, you don't want a magician to show you how he does his tricks. But beyond that, he'll tell anybody how to do anything. But what he really, you know, he's not suggesting to other chefs that they copy him or that they do what he does. His message, I think, to younger chefs or even older chefs who happen to be influenced by him is, you know, anything is possible. Think for yourself. Try to, you know, break out of what you've been taught. Now that you've been taught it, and absorb the basic lessons, now think about what else you can do. Where can you go with that? And he doesn't care if you take it in the direction of spherification or deconstruction, or if you come up with something entirely new. I think he'd probably be more pleased.
Well, didn't I read in the book somewhere that was his inspiration? Was he was told by a mentor, don't copy?
Right. The he went to as a very young. I mean, he was in his early 20s. He was taken on a tour with some other Spanish chefs to the south of France, and ended up at a lecture demonstration given by Jacques Maximin, who was one of the a little bit forgotten now, but one of the sort of slightly later generation Nouveau Cuisine chefs who was very, very original. And he said in the course of this lecture, somebody said, what does creativity mean? And he said, creativity means not copying. And Ferran later said that actually the that was a revelation to him. It had never occurred to him before, and it was such a simple formulation. But he also said, you have to remember, when this happened, which was 1987, people didn't use the word creative with chefs very much. A creative act was writing a piece of music or painting a painting. And it's hard to think of that today, hard to believe that today, because we use the term so loosely with chefs. But in those days, a chef wasn't supposed to be creative. He was supposed to copy the canon
he was a technician.
Yeah, he was supposed to be technically sound. Exactly what I was going to say.
He was supposed to be technically sound. He could add his own little touches, but he wasn't supposed to go off in his own direction. And that was a real revelation to Ferran, I think.
Well, so in talking about revelations, Ferran is an unusual character who has an unusual career path to be one of the best chefs in the world. Why don't you tell folks where he came from, like how he came to be at the helm of El Bulli, and then how the hell El Bulli in the middle of nowhere became one of the most famous restaurants in the world.
Actually, in the middle of nowhere.
Really?
Yeah, literally. Well, it's a funny story because first of all, he did not found El Bulli, and it was very much up and running and very successful. Well, moderately, certainly artistically successful before he ever got there. Never made a lot of money, but Ferran started. He was born in a big industrial town right next to Barcelona. And had no particular interest in food as a young man, and wasn't brought up in a particularly food-conscious household any more than any other Spanish household would have been. And he got his first kitchen job as a dishwasher because he wanted to spend the summer in Ibiza drinking beer and looking at girls, and needed to make some money. And his father happened to know an old army buddy who was a chef at a hotel restaurant, and got him a job there. And so he washed dishes and started getting a chance to help out a little bit, preparing some food, and, you know, it seemed like an okay way to make money. So he went to Ibiza, spent the summer there, worked in a restaurant there for a little extra money, and then kept doing that when he came back. But he wasn't committed to it. It wasn't, he says he wasn't passionate about it. He didn't think of it as his life or his career. It was just a way to make some money, to have fun. And he was quite a party animal in the early days.
Yeah, how do you get from that to the best chef in the world?
Well, you know, he went into the Navy and was attached to the, because he'd had some cooking experience, to the household of an admiral who was quite a food lover. And he and another young man, a friend of his named Fermi Puch, spent a lot of time cooking and making up dishes. And Puch had worked as a very lowly kitchen employee at this restaurant called El Bulli. If I can backtrack a little bit to the history of that place, it was opened in 1959. A piece of property was opened as a mini golf course by a German doctor and his wife, and the mini golf course didn't do much.
Now we're not talking miniature golf with windmills.
We're talking miniature golf.
I have had some killer hot dogs at miniature golf places, so let's not disparage
them. Well,
you
would have had something close to that, because what they did eventually was they opened what the Spanish call a chiringuito, which is a beachfront, like a palapa almost, just a shack to serve soft drinks and beer and sandwiches to the people that were on the beach. And little by little by little, they put a grill in and started cooking hot food. And then the German doctor loved French food and loved all great French restaurants. And he had a kind of a crazy dream that he'd bring that to his far-off, isolated place. And he did, little by little. And when Ferran went there for the first time to apprentice for a few months, the restaurant had two Michelin stars and a French chef who was the youngest two-star chef in Europe. So that was before the Ferran Adria era. Then he did very well as an apprentice and was invited to come back. And he just had that knack. And he, 2 years later, was sharing head chef duties with a Spanish chef. And a year after that, was in charge of the whole kitchen.
So he went from dishwasher to chef, basically, with really no formal training.
Right,
other
than 5 or 6 years. Yeah, absolutely.
That's insane.
He had that kind of mind. And, you know, he didn't know he had that kind of mind, I guess, but apparently he was wonderful with attention to detail. The man that was the manager, and still is now his business partner in the restaurant, but was the manager who hired him, said, you know, he was always the guy that you said, you know, how many sardines do we have left in the walk-in? And he'd know exactly, and he'd know what they had to work with. He'd know what to do with it. And he was just, you could trust him to take care of things. He just had that kind of a mind.
Well, when we come back on the other side of the break, we've taken Ferran Adria from dishwasher to chef of El Bulli, untrained and unknown. And when we come back on the other side of the break, Coleman Anders is going to tell us how we go from there to El Bulli being the most sought-after reservation, really, in the whole world. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Captain Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the restaurant guys sent you. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're having a fascinating conversation with Coleman Anders. His book on Ferran Adria is available now in stores. You can pick it up on our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com. And it's called Ferran, The Inside Story of El Bulli and the Man Who Reinvented Food. Before the break, you took us, Coleman, on our crazy, unremarkable thus far biography of Ferran Adria, who is now at the helm of El Bulli, this restaurant in the middle of nowhere, which has had some fame in the past, cooking more traditional food. And how does it become the most innovative, certainly, restaurant in the world? And how does it come to people's attention and rise to just the incredible heights of fame it currently has?
Right. Well, the development was very slow, which was probably good, because it was isolated, because for many, many years, it did very badly. They'd fill the restaurant in a few months in the summer, and then through the winter, they'd have one customer a night sometimes, or no customers a night sometimes. And so that actually was probably good for the development of Ferran's food, because he had a lot of time to think about stuff. He had a lot of time to try things out. He had a small but very talented group of people working with him. And little by little, his food just kind of left the planet. I mean, it wasn't one day when he came in and suddenly started throwing things around in a different way, but what he realized was that there was no good reason not to use some tools and some appliances and some materials that had not been commonly used to make food. And, you know, he's been accused or labeled as being a chemical chef, somebody that cooks with chemicals. Well, what does that mean? As he's very fond of saying, if I told my mother, who was very old-fashioned, traditional, if I told her that I was going to make her fish cooked in sodium chloride, she'd say, oh, no, Ferran, you know I don't like that chemical food. If I told her the same thing, that I was cooking her a fish baked in salt, she would love it.
Right, right.
You know, and so why is sodium chloride, table salt, why is that fine to use, and calcium chloride isn't fine to use or something? So obviously there are chemical compounds which are toxic or have ill effect on people. He doesn't use those. He uses a lot of things that have been very commonly used in pastry making and in commercial food production, and he's found fine cooking, haute cuisine applications for them, like agar-agar, which is a naturally occurring seaweed thickener. Carrageenan, which is another one, and things like that just were not commonly used in fine dining kitchens.
You know, it's funny. I remember an episode of Top Chef where they had a molecular gastronomy challenge, and one of the guys said a very interesting thing. He didn't do well in the challenge. And I just thought it was very interesting. He said, "You know, I've worked my whole life to get these
chemicals out of the kitchen, and now I have to cook with them. This is not what I want to do. And I think it's interesting, though, there's a difference between agar-agar and, you know, and artificial preservatives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that it's important to draw that distinction.
There's a big difference. Iran is always looking for purity and simplicity in his food, as strangely as that may sound. And he showed me one time he had just some liquid that it could even have been water on a stove, and he stirred in cornstarch, which everybody uses, and, you know, every kind of, I mean, very common ingredient in all kinds of cooking. And he showed me how much cornstarch he had to put in and how long it took to thicken the water into kind of a syrupy consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did the same thing with agar-agar and put a little tiny bit in, and 10 seconds later, it had reached the same thickness that mm-hmm. the cornstarch. So he said, you know, to him, that's an advantage.
Sure.
He's using a different compound, but it's just as natural,
mm-hmm.
and it affects the raw material far less because you're using less of it.
Yeah.
But he did things like this, and as his food developed, he started being known by his fellow chefs, especially in Spain, and a little bit in France, and Joël Robuchon, the great French chef, discovered him at one point and went on French television and scandalized the French culinary establishment by saying, this man is the next really important chef after me. The real turning point for him came when the New York Times Magazine, not quite 10 years ago now, did a cover story, which was ostensibly about how Spain, in many ways, culinary and other arts, was kind of taking the place of France.
I remember that article.
But Ferran was on the cover, and it turned out to be an article largely about him, and it went on for 7,000-8,000 words, and that really was like overnight. It became impossible to get a table at the restaurant. That's obviously a very influential publication, and the article made it sound like this was the most amazing man in the world, and which he is certainly up there with it.
And when did you discover Ferran, Andrea?
Well, I had actually been to the restaurant in the old days in 1985 when he was co-chef with a Spanish chef, and a friend of mine in Barcelona had recommended that I try it. Unfortunately, I don't remember a thing that I ate. I remember it was pretty good, but it was in those days it would have been in more or less French Nouvelle Cuisine.
Right.
And then I met Ferran again. I started hearing about him like anybody in the 90s and like anybody that was paying attention to food probably in the late 90s. And at one point, our mutual friend, Jose Andres, who had worked in Ferran's kitchen, is now a very prominent Spanish chef in this country.
Amazing chef in Washington.
Really, yeah, Washington, and now he's in Los Angeles,
right.
And he's about to open in Las Vegas, too. But he said, you know, my friend Ferran is coming, and you should meet him. And so we got together and had lunch. And then after that, I kind of kept in touch with him. But I didn't actually eat again at El Bulli for a number of years until maybe, I want to say, about 4 years ago. And then I realized it was something pretty unusual. And
he wasn't initially really receptive to having he's famously self-effacing. He wasn't really keen on having a biography done of him initially.
No, he said, I'm too young for a biography, and I'm too busy, and he had a lot of excuses. And really, Jose Andres, I describe him in the acknowledgments as kind of having been kind of the godfather of this book, because he kept after Ferran every time he'd see him, every time he'd talk to him. You know, you really should let Coleman do that.
I understand. Jose said something to you like, well, next time you're in Catalonia,
right.
You know, you can stop by. And then you, like, booked a flight to Catalonia and said,
exactly.
As a matter of fact.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He finally let his guard down that much. And we sat and over dinner and talked. And I think I must have somehow convinced him that, you know, I would do a good job. And I think his main motivation in saying yes to this and giving me the great access that he gave me was that, well, I asked him when we did a conversation on stage in New York a few weeks ago, I said, what is the biggest misconception about El Bulli? And he said, total, everything. He says that so much has been written about him and about the restaurant, but so much of that is wrong. And I think he looked on this book as a chance to kind of set the record straight about a lot of stuff, both historical and more conceptual.
And he also sees himself as just one of the working parts here that El Bulli. I mean, his brother's a big part, and there are other people who kind of help bring that all together. He doesn't see himself as the be all end all.
No, exactly. He talks very much about his about the team and the importance of the creative core of his team. Of course, the what you haven't brought up yet, you probably are about to, is the fact that he has also announced that he is closing the restaurant.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
At the end of the next year's season, which will be the end of July of 2011. But then if you say, why are you closing the restaurant, they'll say, I'm not closing the restaurant.
Right. He says he's going to reopen it and remodel it and all that stuff. Is that true?
Well, he says it's a two-plus year hiatus or sabbatical. And when it reopens, it will not be a restaurant in the sense that it is now. It will be a foundation with an educational mission, which he envisions as he describes it now. And you have to remember that this is a guy that probably has 10 ideas if he's talking to you for 10 minutes.
Right.
I'm sure his specifics will change. But what he is talking about now is to have about 20 to 30 professionals from mostly from cooking chefs and restaurateurs, but also occasional other creative people who will come for 1 year to El Bulli and have basically an immersion course in gastronomic history and culture and everything surrounding it. Not a cooking school, but a way to teach people the underpinnings of cuisine. All a little little hard to.
Kind of amazing.
Specific about, and everybody, of course, wants to know. Well, will food be served? And he says, "Well, yes, of course, we're cooks, but I don't know exactly. Maybe it will be. Maybe we'll change every 2 months, and or maybe we'll only be open for 1 month a year, or maybe we'll be open more, but we'll only serve 8 people a night, or maybe we'll have a big cafe and serve a lot of people, or you know, it's very much up in the air, but there will be some kind of food, and it will definitely reopen. And in fact, he's made a big deal with Telefonica, which is the third largest telecommunications company in the world, Spanish-based, but with enterprises internationally. And they are installing what will be 3 years from now the absolute latest equipment that will allow him. Anything that's done at this foundation will be streamed in real time all over the world online.
Well, you know that Francis and I are striving to fill our restaurants every single day, and so it is foreign to us the thought of someone whose restaurant is full every single day to think about closing that restaurant in order to change it and do something different.
Well, as he points out, he made a business decision some years ago to close for lunch, so he'd only be serving one meal a day, and he said that in effect cut their income in half. But he thought that was important because they could not keep up the level of innovation that he was interested in serving two meals a day.
Well, Coleman, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you before we go, what was the most surprising thing or the misconception that most people have that isn't true, or the most surprising thing you found out about Ferran Adrià or El Bulli? What caught you by surprise?
Well, the first thing that caught me by surprise, and I should have anticipated this, but is the fact that his own culinary tastes, his own food tastes, are extremely simple and traditional. That he completely separates what he does professionally from his personal life, and that includes his eating habits. He would much rather have a few slices of good Spanish ham or a hunk of good bread dipped in olive oil than any fine manipulation of technique of the kind that he does himself.
Huh.
That was really a surprise to me. And I think the other thing is that doesn't immediately become apparent is that he has a great sense of humor. And he jokes all the time. His food has a lot of humor to it. And people's reactions, a lot of times when something is put in front of them, if they're not too uptight about it and don't come in with a chip on their shoulder, assuming they're not going to like it, it's just to laugh or to smile. He's not a serious man in a way, although he takes his creativity very seriously. But that was very nice. I really liked finding that out. I took a chef friend of mine from New York there for his birthday last month, and this is a guy who was just named for having the best roast chicken in New York City, and, you know, very simple cooking.
Uh-huh.
And he was just blown away, and he said, this is nothing like I expected, and I like it a lot more than I thought I would. And I think people that think it's all pretentious and silly just don't understand.
Huh.
It's not that at all. Anyway.
I think that the point you hit on earlier about him liking simple foods and, you know, that almost preferring that for his own eating habits, I think that's very common of chefs. You immerse yourself in all of this kind of haute cuisine. It's sometimes all you want to do is have a nice simple cheeseburger or something like that. You know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you've surrounded yourself with venison and bison. And now, you know, maybe just a simple cheeseburger is all I wanted, some popcorn.
Sure. But the interesting thing is that his food really, despite the fact that it's very manipulated in many ways and all that, the flavors of the food are often just as simple as the kinds of stuff he likes to eat himself.
Well, and, you know, just along the aesthetic line of things as well, he lives very simply, doesn't he?
He does. He really doesn't have a home, he says. He sleeps either at the restaurant or across the road from the restaurant. He and his wife have a little tiny apartment in Barcelona, which it's only since he's been married that he's had that. Before that, he slept at home in his parents' apartment in the same bedroom that he'd slept in all his life.
That's so wild.
He doesn't have a fancy car. He has a little Japanese or Korean car, very unassuming, and, you know, doesn't spend a lot of money on clothes, and really spends most of his money, I think, probably on eating and drinking and traveling.
This sounds like my kind of guy. He has his priorities in good order, I think. And Coleman, so do you. Thank you for writing the book, and thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much.
And you heard it on the air here. Coleman Andrews promised to get me and Mark reservations at El Bulli. Thank you, Coleman. That was great.
Right. But the bad news is they're for tonight.
You know what you don't know about Francis and me very well?
I'll get over there.
We would be there.
You'd be there, yeah.
Coleman Andrews' book is Ferran, Inside Story of El Bulli and the Man Who Reinvented Food. Check it out on RestaurantGuysRadio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. I was really hoping that he was going to get us a reservation.
I did it as a joke. We have about 7 hours to get there.
I did it as a joke because it would have been too ballsy to ask, but I was hoping he'd say, oh, no, I can get your reservation if you want. But notice he didn't say that. It was a complete out, and he was fast with the joke, too.
Okay, because I'm sure that he's been asked 7,000 times that question.
He can't get any reservation. I'm going to work on it. I'm putting out a challenge right now. I've decided it's going to close in 2 years. I got two seasons to get us in to El Bulli in outside of Barcelona. I'm going to work on it starting today. If you hear
it is here, I go to a lot of restaurants, and Francis goes to a lot of restaurants.
Hundreds of thousands of reservation requests.
I don't know that there's any restaurant. There is no restaurant higher on my list of I want to go to that restaurant.
And it's going to close, pal.
There is no restaurant higher on the list.
And it's been there for years. Well, because it's foundational. It's a reference point to a change in the way people look at food. And some of those people have gone on to do really interesting things, like Jose Andres, and some people, you know, who we're not going to mention, people we don't like. There's no reason to do that. But there are other people who have gone to restaurants that are well-known molecular gastronomists, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, the food there, I'm like, okay, here's a guy who's an amazing at the technique of creating this unusual thing. I only wish I wanted to eat it. You know what I mean?
I have gone to some of those restaurants and said, "Feh."
I'm like, wow, that looks amazing. That feels amazing. That weighs an amazing amount or amazing little. It's not that pleasant to eat.
Yeah.
You know, but I've also been to Madrid. I traveled extensively in Spain. And
also,
I went
restaurants in this country, and certainly dishes in this country at some of those restaurants have been extraordinary.
Yep. Well, you know, the other thing about molecular gastronomy, and I know that he doesn't like to call it that, but this new movement of thinking outside of the box of traditional food.
Not as new as it was when we started the show.
Right. It's funny. That's right. We've really been alive for half of the development of molecular gastronomy. But, I mean, alive. The show has been alive. But I think that it's sort of like when you look at what Ferran Adrià is doing and some of the people on the cutting edge are doing. Jose Andres is doing it at Cafe Atlantico down in
Washington, D.C.,
which is his little five-stool gem of a place that he does this forward-looking stuff.
I think it's actually six stools.
Well, you want to have couples.
Well, you sold them short by 20%.
That's true. Well, but I think it's like going to a fashion show. You know, you see these crazy new designs that maybe are appropriate opening night of the ballet in New York City, and that's it. They're couture fashion. But what you see there percolates down in some form into fashion, you know, and I think that that's sort of where how we can look at a lot of this.
Cause thank goodness it doesn't come directly down, because I look terrible in gossamer dresses with frills.
I think about it every night. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys as much as we have. Horrifying. I'm Francis Schott.
I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.